Kansas City is full of entrepreneurs. Pick up a rock, throw it, and you'll probably hit one. Oops.
Ow!
Sorry. Sorry about that.
Ow, ow, ow!
Yeesh, sorry about that. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, a look at tech tools to help you launch your new business with our pals, the Computer Guys. From keeping the books to outsourcing your entire HR department, we'll hear what online tools and technology tools you should know about. Plus, we'd love to hear from you on what tech tools are essential in the work that you do, in the business you're in, or in the business you're about to start. Join the conversation with the Computer Guys. Plus, stay tuned for our technology news lightning round. That's ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. Some have visions of IPOs dancing in their heads, while some just want to work for themselves. Some were forced to stretch their creativity due to a layoff, while others left the security and stability of corporate America for the uncertainty of entrepreneurship. Whatever your entry or exit point, there's help out there. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today, a discussion about startups and the technology tools business owners and aspiring entrepreneurs can use to kick things off and, for that matter, keep them kicking. Joining us once again are Central Standard's IT department. The Computer Guys are here. George Costello, an independent Apple consultant, and Thomas O'Brien, CEO of Bold Internet Solutions. And they're going to help us make sense of the DIY business world. And also joining us to help us with that is Lisa Mitchell, VP of Innovation at the Kauffman Foundation, and later on, Scott Levitan from Google joining us from that company's Mountain View headquarters. Tom, George, you're entrepreneurs in your own right. Remind us how you got started and tell us how your world of consultative services is changing. George, first.
Well, you don't want to use me as a role model. I did all the wrong things. Didn't do any research, didn't have a business plan, just a crazy idea. But because I was small, and I intended to stay small, I didn't get hurt in the process.
What was your crazy idea?
Well, I backed into what I do. I mean, it was just a situation where I was a member of the local Macintosh users group, and I went there because I didn't know anything, and I figured that was a good place to learn. So over time, I let the information kind of soak in. And then one day, somebody asked me to help them, and then another person asked me. And after a while, I said, hey, one guy actually offered to pay me. And so I said, gee, there might be a business here. And that's how it started for me.
So for him, it was, gee, there might be a business here. Thomas O'Brien, what was it for you?
Kind of the same thing. I found myself constitutionally unable to work for somebody else.
You mean Thomas Jefferson's document?
Yeah, my constitution was written in such a way that prevented me from being a very good employee. I knew I was a terrible employee because I was always off doing other things, moonlighting and lunch lighting and morning lighting. So, I finally decided just to go off on my own and do my own thing.
And how's that work for you?
Well, it's worked out really great. But one thing I wanted to mention right off the bat is that when I did this, there were not the resources that there are now.
True.
And if I had could take advantage of some of these resources, it'd be really, really cool because we kind of had to learn the hard way, make a lot of mistakes. I think that's probably really good anyway. But I think people need to understand that they have permission to make mistakes and they have permission to take risks and it's okay to fail.
Is it easier to be an entrepreneur today than it was 10 or 15 years ago, Lisa Mitchell?
Well, I think there's a significant amount of resources available today that might not have been available 10 or 15 years ago.
Does that make it easier?
I don't know.
Might make it more confusing.
It might make it more confusing. I think most entrepreneurs, including Mr. Kauffman, went about being an entrepreneur in a similar way that you did. I mean, he just started and saw a market hole and went about filling it with probably not a lot of access to resources, but what he did have access to, and I think what we've seen in our community for years with Barnett Helzberg and Hemp and other programs like that, is he had access to mentors and advisors. And mentors and advisors have always been around.
Well, and that's really the key. I mean, even if you are a dummy and you want to go into business, the real secret is having the vision to be able to spot a need and then being able to fill it. I mean, even if you stumble, you know, while you're trying to do that because you lack certain skills, if you are good at spotting the need and you're good at filling it, you've got a good shot at succeeding.
Is the difference today that entrepreneurship is more deliberate?
In some cases, but clearly in some cases, I'm sure the answer would be exactly as these guys have said. I mean, what's the difference today is I think we have data that shows that the increase in jobs is based upon companies that are less than 5 years old. So, you know, when that happens, everybody is suddenly interested. Entrepreneurship is more mainstream than it used to be. Significant number of universities teach different kinds of entrepreneurial programs. And, you know, frankly, with the whole Web 2.0 movement, there's a significant amount of technology tools, et cetera, that are available online for you to find out about other people's ideas and figure out how to move yours forward.
Now, Lisa Mitchell, you're the VP of Innovation at the Kauffman Foundation. How do you get business people to take innovation beyond the buzzword it's become? And when people ask you that you're the VP of Innovation, what do you do? Yes. How do you stretch innovation beyond a concept?
So what we mean by innovation, there's inventors, you know, people who literally create something from scratch, Thomas Edison, Bill Gates in some cases with hardware. I would say Steve Jobs was an innovator, putting pieces and parts together that were already at, pieces of technology that were already out there. And, you know, but for somebody creating iTunes, the rest of this wouldn't have worked. And our interest, I would say, we think about innovation in a very broad construct, not something narrow and, you know, cool and unique, but very broadly. How do we get more ideas into the marketplace, and how do we take them from being ideas and turning them into something concrete? I mean, I think it was Thomas Edison that said, you know, an invention is great, but 99% of it is perspiration and what it takes to move something forward.
And the other 1% is inspiration.
Is the inspiration.
How have the barriers to entry changed for better or worse in starting a business?
Yeah, you know, I think, and one of you guys just made this comment, while there is access to lots of tools online, frankly, there's so much out there. It's kind of like big data. There's so much data out there. How do you find when you do Google search? 5 years ago, what you could find is different than what you find today. And what you find today is lots of junk. And so the question is, you know, there's tons of stuff out there. What, in fact, is good and what's not good in terms of what will help entrepreneurs is what you have to sort through.
How do you pare down all that information that's online?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you can pare down the information that's online. What you have to do is figure out what your kind of trusted and credible sources are. Just to give you an example, you know, I work with lots of people in the life science space, and you know, if you get sick, immediately your family members want to go on Google and start Googling what's wrong with you and what are the outcomes that they should be expecting. And I always tell people, go directly to the Mayo Clinic website. That is one trusted website that we know they devote resources to curation. And it's curation, actually, that's a little bit of the problem and the opportunity.
So tell us about some of the programs at Kauffman that help startups or business people trying to get started pare down that information and determine what the trusted sources are.
Sure. So a couple that are in kind of the how do we get more innovation out there. One, we created a platform called the iBridge Network about 5 years ago. And our interest in the iBridge Network is we knew so many institutions, whether they be universities, federal labs, et cetera, were creating all of these new ideas. But unfortunately, unless you could like walk in the right door, you were never going to find it. And so our thought process was, why don't we create a platform to create transparency and access to these ideas so that the pull market can get in and find them? So, you know, we know that Siemens and, you know, Bayer and a number of big companies literally get into the website every day, look for what's new that's out there. And we get shocking phone calls. A gentleman at Bayer in Frankfurt called me one day and told me that he was so thrilled that he found this endometriosis mouse model that nobody even knows what that is, but he found this endometriosis mouse model on the iBridge network at a university that he'd never heard of. And I said, really, what university is that? And he said, Penn State. I mean, so
he'd never heard of Penn State.
No, he'd never heard of it. But that tells you why we felt like we needed to create the platform. So that's one at the very nascent idea stage. If you kind of move along the pipeline, iStart is a platform that we created, frankly, because we saw all of these competitions, whether they're idea competitions or business models or business plans or whatever. We saw all these competitions taking place. Everybody was, essentially trying to put together their own platform for doing it. They weren't happening enough. And frankly, what we think is that experiential opportunities are the best for entrepreneurs. You actually get in. I mean, you use the acronym DIY. You know, DIY entrepreneurship is getting in and actually doing it.
Is that an acronym?
And so iStart was a platform that we created to provide literally an easy way for anybody to run a competition anywhere. And ultimately, what we wanted to do with the back end of iStart is allow some of these founders, people who compete in the competitions. And what we heard a lot of times was, engineering students who are matched up with an MBA student, they win a competition. The MBA student goes off and works for McKinsey, and the engineer is left laying there by the road with his great idea. And so on the back end of iStart, allows people to match up, or allows you, if you think you're going to start this great new company with Macintosh skills, to go out and find out if there's 500 other people doing it or if you're first in market. So those are just a couple of examples.
This is Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall, along with George Costello, an independent Apple and Mac consultant, Tom O'Brien, the CEO of Ideology. We also have Lisa Mitchell, VP of Innovation at the Kauffman Foundation. We're discussing being an entrepreneur and what tech tools allow you to further that process of being an entrepreneur. Kansas City, what area resources and tech tools have been essential to your venture, your business venture? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Now, Thomas, you went through the Kauffman Fast Track program.
Long ago.
Yeah, tell us about that process and how it enhanced you and what you've been doing ever since and using ever since.
It's so long ago I hardly remember, but I'll tell you this. I viewed myself as a particular kind of expert, but not as a business person. And so when it came to running the business, there was a lot to learn. And one of the first things to learn was, what's a business plan and how do you create it? And that's what Fast Track helped us do, is it forced me every week to do the homework to create the business plan, and then I was able to kind of fill in the dots from there. So even though it wasn't something that, it wasn't magic, it was a lot of hard work and a lot of unanswered questions that kind of occurred, but there was a group of us, and that support from the group is pretty handy because there are other startup people in the Fast Track program, and you can kind of commiserate with them, if you will, and kind of find out what they're doing and share their experiences along with yours. So, that was probably that was business number two. Business number one, it benefited from business number two because I went through Fast Track. I just did them both at the same time. I only paid for one, though. hope nobody does anything about that.
Lisa, how much of entrepreneurship is determining what stage you're actually at in starting a business?
I think it's important simply in terms of figuring out what's your competition. I mean, the worst thing that can happen is you run 100 miles ahead and develop a plan, go out and get your family and friends and fools to fund you, and then find out you're 95th in the market.
The three Fs, family, friends, and fools.
Yes, exactly. that doesn't work so well, and sometimes people are upset with you. So clearly figuring out where you are in the pipeline starts with doing your research and making sure that you understand your market. The great example I think you used, George, is you were early. you were really early
in
the market.
And that's true.
If you came in today and said, here's the business I'm going to start, you would be, you know, the 102,000th
You'd be the, yeah, right,
person.
The millionth, actually.
Actually, in Kansas City, that's not true. There's a surprisingly small number of people who make house calls, if you will. And that was really the secret to that was part of it. But, you know, we're talking in generalities here. I know that I went through a period of many years where I was like Tom. I was not a good employee, and I knew I was going to have to do my own thing if I was going to be happy. So over the course of a lot of years, as I was thinking about what kind of business, you know, do I want to get into, I mean, it's pretty obvious that if you do something that's fairly common, like let's say opening a restaurant, you know, for example, there are 6 jillion restaurants and an awful lot of good ones, which means it's a real uphill struggle. But in my case, I picked a niche, you know, in a new area of developing computers. So that made me a little more unique and I think was a contributor to my ability to succeed.
Kansas City, what tech tools and resources have been essential to your venture? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Kristen writes to us at centralstandard@kcur.org, where you can write in, by the way. Kristen writes, 3 years ago, we started a marketing agency focused exclusively on professional services firms, law, accounting firms, etc. We have explored many, many online tech tools to help our clients and help keep us sane, Kristen says. We like Dropbox for client files. Clients love it. It's easy, secure, and helps us share documents. As of today, we're starting to use a virtual assistant, Life Enzyme, to help us with tasks from managing spreadsheets to proofing documents. We can easily budget and bill for many of these services as their rates are certainly lower than our rates. And that's an interesting point that Kristen brings up. Thank you for those thoughts, Kristen, at centralstandard@kcur.org, where you can write in with similar thoughts. The basics of running a business have changed and are easier due to tech tools such as the Dropbox, such as Life Enzyme, and being able to outsource basic functions. Talk about that, Tom.
Well, you know, one of the biggest impacts on running a business is government.
Mm-hmm.
You've got taxes, you've got all sorts of municipal, state, county, federal things you got to deal with. And my mantra all along has been, outsource it. If you're not an expert at it, have somebody who is do it. And even though the cost of it is a cost to your business, ultimately, if you do it well, you're going to be you're not going to have the headaches. You know, if you try to do your own tax filings, you'll make a mistake, you get the notices back, and then you have to spend a lot of time not doing what you're trying to do, just dealing with the government. So, you know, I looked at outsourcing really early, and outsourcing whole chunks of how to run the business, outsource accounting, outsource human resources, you know, Kristen said, outsource some of the errand running that you need to do. And then as you grow, then you can decide whether you can bring that stuff back in or not.
Right.
How has the world of managed services and outsourcing, Lisa, changed the way people do business?
Yeah, it's changed completely the way people do business. And a plug I'd like to put in, does everybody know that the Dropbox technology founder is from Kansas City?
Now we know.
Now
we
learned
something new.
So lots of entrepreneurs around here.
Central Standard every day.
Yes, exactly. I think lived about 3 blocks away from here. Obviously, it's changed completely, and there is a component, as a matter of fact, within Kauffman Fast Track workshop now, where you think through what are you insourcing and what are you outsourcing. And I think your point is so important in terms of it depends based upon the life cycle of your company. When you're very early and you don't have a lot of these funds, it's really important to figure out, you know, who's got the pieces and parts that I can use. And what's important to know is that a lot of these pieces and parts are free. We're partnering with the Case Foundation right now to do something called Startup America Partnership. And if you go to the Startup America Partnership website and you sign up as either a new co or a co that's been around a while and you're looking to ramp up, there are a significant number of free resources available there. Everything from, you know, a Microsoft Starter Pack to Amazon Cloud Services to Intuit Services. So there's a lot of things that you could outsource. And frankly, due to this initiative of Startup America Partnership, there's a lot of free resources that you can get available, and you should take advantage of those while they're free.
We got Patrick calling from Lone Jack, Missouri. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hello.
Hello, Patrick.
Yes. It's been my observation, having been an entrepreneur in several different things. I went to work for somebody, learned the business, and then noticed the niches they weren't serving, and then figured I could serve them. And it's not dishonest. It's just I'm more nimble than a larger company.
That's a good point. That's a good point that Patrick makes. These outsourced services, HR, accounting, clerical services that can make you seem big, these managed services can help you compete with the big boys. Thomas?
Sure. You can outsource your entire phone system. You know, you don't really even have and there's co-working spaces that you can go to that will give you an office and all the support you need, including a copier, which I've never had. So that you don't have to spend the money, which is great. And that's something that I think you need to keep in mind too, is that there's this sort of valley. I think Kaufman calls it the valley of death, which sounds very dire, by the way. But
tell us about the valley of death that the Kaufman espouses.
I feel like
I need an echo.
I don't think the Kaufman Foundation made up the valley of death.
No, it's just a place that people find themselves.
Right.
Yeah, which is obviously, especially depending upon the kind of company that you're starting. If you're starting a capital intensive company, whether that be hardware or life science or whatever, the likelihood that you are going to not make money and owe a lot of money in terms of your funders for an extended period of time is high if you're in those kind of businesses. So that's the dip that it's referring to. And obviously your ability to shorten that dip and get to revenue is the valley of death, and that's what you have to figure out what to focus on in terms of how do we reduce the valley of death.
So what types of programs do you have to reduce the shadow of the valley of death and bring companies to leadeth them beside the still waters?
Well, I think, and this isn't Kaufman programs, but these are programs that are out there. I mean, just last week, the Jobs Act, I think, passed in the Senate, and one of the important components of the Jobs Act was this crowdfunding. And I think we've learned, the for-profit world has learned from the not-for-profit world, which started with things like Kiva, which was microfunding at a crowdsourcing level. Kiva Detroit happened last year because we realized people were actually willing to fund, you know, small businesses in Detroit as much as they were in Bangladesh. And now we've seen Kickstarter, which, again, I think people think that's totally for not-for-profits. It's not. There's, you know, for-profit kinds of stuff on there. And AngelList, which is an organization out in Silicon Valley, which is, I would call, a kind of mashup between crowdfunding and referral services for early-stage entrepreneurs, can all get you to reducing the valley of death.
When you talk about Kickstarter and online presence such as that, is that sort of a new avenue, a newer avenue for funding?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as I said, Kiva had been around, founded by the former PayPal founders, has been around for a number of years, but it was viewed as, you know, micro lending in developing countries when suddenly they said, you know, we have some similar characteristics to developing countries in a number of different cities, and started using it. And it absolutely has been working. And Kickstarter, I don't remember the number, but I know they've passed the 100 million mark or something as of a couple of months ago. And so it's global. AngelList is also huge. I think we'll see multiple competitors come online. One of the interesting things about AngelList, as I said, is it requires a referral. So, you know, one of the things that I mentioned earlier that we know about entrepreneurship is it's very much tied to your network and your advisors and your mentors. And if your advisors and mentors can refer you into AngelList through somebody else, that referral mechanism is going to get you closer to other funding if you need outside funding. And I have to say, you know, our number one recommendation for all entrepreneurs is don't take money from anybody you don't need. I mean, get customers. That's the best way to create funding is get customers. It's non-dilutive.
Actually have a revenue stream.
Yes.
Actually have a business going before you get funding.
Grow organically.
Grow organically. Speaking of growing organically, have you used, Thomas, any online resources for competing for bids for potential clients?
You know, we don't do that, but we're interested in it. And that's one of the reasons I kind of wanted to talk about this today is to learn a little bit more. I think it's a growing opportunity because the market is huge. And the way you get business anymore is different than it was, you know, 20 or 15 years ago. You used to be able to just pick off the phone or cold call people. You can't do that anymore. You have to reach people through new technology because they're going to find you. It's that kind of affinity sort of marketing that seems to be really successful these days as opposed to the old, you know, pound the pavement kind of marketing, which is admittedly very inefficient. But I think a lot of people still do it. But, you know, now your customers are out there looking for you. The question is can they find you? And I think that's a real trick to be able to kind of come up with a concept of how do you present your business so that people find you.
And how are you paring that down over at the Kauffman Foundation, getting people to find other people?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it is a community building. I mean, one of the reasons that we funded and support Startup Weekend is Startup Weekend is about community building and bringing resources together. When you run a Startup Weekend, the likelihood that people are going to meet each other that have never met before and are coming from completely different fields is very high. And, you know, the number of new codes that we see emerging from Startup Weekends, depending upon if they're in a community that's run them before or not, is really getting to be quite high. And actually companies launched because of the capability of, you know, the miracles of modern technology, the ability to literally start a company in that 54 hours is real.
Our guest for this rousing first half of informational sublimity has been Lisa Mitchell, VP of Innovation at Kauffman Foundation. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And George Costello, an independent Apple consultant, as well as Thomas O'Brien. They comprise our IT department, our computer guys here on Central Standard. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, a look at a program from Google to help local business owners navigate the coming broadband rollout. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We've been talking tech and startups and how to expand a business through the use of leveraging technology. And that discussion now continues with George Costello, an independent Apple consultant, and Thomas O'Brien, CEO of Bold Internet Solutions. But joining us now is Scott Levitan, a marketing executive from Google, joining us from the company's Mountain View headquarters. Welcome to Central Standard, Scott.
Hi, good morning.
Now, tell us about Get Your Business Online, or JIBO, the JIBO initiative here in Missouri and Kansas.
Well, this program started with some research that we did that showed that 63% of businesses in the country do not have a website.
Really?
And if you put that into perspective, and pretty much, you know, I was listening before where one of your panelists was talking about, you know, the key issue is how do you get found online? But when you think that pretty much everyone is looking online for products and services, and you know they're looking at work, they're looking at home, they're on their smartphones, you know, they're connected all the time. So that means that a huge percentage of businesses are invisible, invisible to their customers, to their potential customers. So we created an initiative really to change the perception that getting online is hard and expensive and time-consuming. The program really is all about sort of making it fast, easy, and free for any business in Kansas and in Missouri to get online.
Now, you found that 63% of businesses did not have an online presence. What was the percentage of consumers that are actually online looking for businesses?
97% of people, let's put 97% of people are looking for local products and services online. And so it's, you know, there's a huge discrepancy between businesses being online and people looking online for products and services, which is actually really interesting because a small business person is also a consumer. And so inevitably they're looking for products and services. And what we've heard from them is they recognize it's important because they are using the web every day to look for products and services. But there is that perception out there that getting online as a business is just incredibly hard.
Why is it so important for small businesses to have an online presence? If it's 2012 and there are still 63% of small businesses who aren't online but yet still in business, what's the selling point?
Well, the first thing is actually there was a Boston Consulting Group report that came out yesterday that showed that the growth rates of businesses that are, let's say, kind of actively on the web versus those that are either invisible or kind of have a minimal presence is really double. So, you know, businesses that are on the web doesn't mean they're selling online. Businesses that are on the web are growing twice as fast. So you are in many ways taxing yourselves unnecessarily as a business if you aren't online. And again, you know, I think intuitively all recognize this because if I'm looking for a plumber in Kansas City, I'm going to go look on my phone and or on my laptop and I'll get a map. And the plumbers that don't pop up are just invisible. They have zero chance of getting that call, even if they are the best plumber in town.
So in the era of search engine optimization and Web 2.0 interactive sort of era, as well as mobile commerce coming online and ramping up, how do you define the term online presence?
Well, you know, it's actually a really good question. I think, you know, there's a number of areas which you would think that every business would want to consider. You know, it really starts with this question of how do I get found online? How do I get found whether I'm on my laptop or on my mobile phone? And I think there's a number of different things that a business should think through, like how I would say about getting found online. You know, at a basic level, you have your domain. You know, I'm scottsplumbing.com. And so that sort of is, you know, could be considered part of your starting point where you have your address on the web. And then you put that building on the address, which would be, call it your website. You know, also there's some very interesting tools which enable you to also get found and using a common language. One of them, which Google has, is a product called Google Places, which is a fast, sort of a very easy way for us to understand what kind of a business you are. So we can understand, oh, Scott's Plumbing is a plumber. It's at this location at these hours. So it takes you about like 10 or 15 minutes to get set up, and then it really gets us to know and be able to sort of explain to anybody who's doing a search what kind of a business this is, what you usually see with those red balloons or red pins. And so those to me would be the basic ones. I would say, you know, get your address on the web, which is your domain, get your website, and then make sure you get found on the map, which is critical too.
Scott, Google recently hosted events in the Missouri and Kansas metro area where businesses could, quote-unquote, get online with Google reps. How did that go, and what's the response from local businesses that you've been getting who are newly online, who are newbies in the Internet space?
I mean, here's the incredible thing. So we held an event in Kansas City, I believe it was on August 31st, and we had approximately 700 businesses come in really with the idea of walking in offline and walking out online. And, you know, our experience shows it takes about an hour, you know, about an hour for business to go from offline to online. But since then, on either Kansas or MissouriGetOnline.com, you know, we've seen over 10,000 businesses start the process of getting online. So every day we're seeing businesses get online, which is really incredible because we're, you know, our major objective here is to, you know, besides changing the perception that getting online is hard and expensive, the real big win is making getting online part of business hygiene. You know, it should be, you know, you brush your teeth as a, you know, every day. It wasn't that long ago that people didn't brush their teeth, and we believe every business should be online and should be working on getting online.
Speaking of business hygiene, what do your services entail to keep a business hygienic, as it were?
I mean, I think, you know, again, hygiene is always about the fundamentals. It's things you just should never not do. And in 2012, we believe every business should have a domain, should have a website with that domain, And in many ways should you know, get found and be discoverable on the map. I would actually add a fourth one. And I think it's really important, is your kind of modern-day business card is your email address. And too many businesses these days are using personal email for business purposes, which technically is fine. But, you know, if I'm scottsplumbing@gmail.com...
It doesn't have the same panache, does it?
No, it's not
as scottsplumbing@scottsplumbing.com.
If I'm scott@scottsplumbing.com, that's actually really... Like, that sounds better. Even though I'm a one-man operation, you know, nobody knows that. Okay, all of a sudden I have this credibility. And there are, you know, many opportunities for businesses to get email with your domain. And if you're under, at least with Google, if you're under 10, if you have less than 10 employees, it's free.
That's a pretty interesting proposition. Our area is going to be getting Google Fiber at some point. Does this increase the stress on businesses or the need for businesses to get online now? Scott?
In 2012, getting online is imperative for a business. And we're already seeing a huge difference in growth rates between online businesses and those that are not yet online. And obviously the rollout of fiber and faster broadband speeds combined with increased smartphone penetration will only increase the pressure.
How do businesses make the leap to e-commerce? Because being online isn't necessarily denoting you doing business online or transactions online. So how do you make that leap after you've gotten your website and your domain and your personal email doesn't say Yahoo or Gmail? How do you make the leap to e-commerce?
Actually, I don't think that every business should make the leap to e-commerce. I think for the vast majority of businesses, it's not necessary to sell online. It's not necessary for the plumber or the dry cleaner or the lawyer. I mean, I think the most important thing for, the vast majority of businesses is that they're discoverable online. And people know who they are, how to reach them, and that, you know, different services like search engines are able to effectively understand the kind of business they have, so they can make the connection between people who are looking for them and their business.
Search engines like, say, I don't know, Google.
It's one of them.
So how important is search engine optimization, and what are you telling local companies about ratcheting up their search engine optimization to get that better ranking in the search space? Because there's a lot of businesses out there with websites. So how do you differentiate yourself in terms of optimizing your searchability?
I think, you know, I would say that, you know, again, focusing on the fundamentals. I mean, the most important thing, you know, is to help us and your customers understand the core of what it is you do. So, and it's not about putting a lot of marketing speak. It's a lot of putting in a lot of the fundamentals into your content. So, for example, if you're the dry cleaner and you specialize in wedding dresses, you know, that needs to be very, very prominent. You know, so when someone is looking for a wedding dress dry cleaner in Kansas City, that you show up. And when someone is looking for somebody else, maybe you don't. So it's really it's about making sure you can be found in the moments that matter.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR and streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We've been talking with Scott Levitan, a marketing executive with Google, joining us by phone from the company's Mountain View office about marketing and small businesses having an online presence. Thank you for coming on Central Standard, Mr. Levitan.
Thank you for having me.
And meanwhile, back to our computer guys, George Costello, an independent Mac consultant, and Thomas O'Brien, the CEO of Ideality. And it's time for our favorite part of the show.
It's time now for a technology news lightning round with Thomas O'Brien and George Costello.
And we're back on the tech lightning round. Thomas, World Backup Day coming up the day before April Fool's. What does that mean? Is this dancing, or this has something to do with data?
Has something to do with data. Back up your hard drive. Back up your hard drive. And I have to say it again. People don't do it, and World Backup Day is just a gimmick to make you remember it's the day before All Fool's Day, which is pretty funny, I thought.
Yeah, don't be an April Fool.
So is there any pervasive synchronicity in backing up the data?
There will be no parades. No fireworks.
No
nothing
parties.
Like that.
No dances.
No dances.
No just, back it up like you're saving your work.
That's right.
No dances.
Just do it. That one thing I do want to mention, though, is a lot of people back up to flash drives and, the little thing that you stick in your USB port. And we found out that there is a lifespan to those things. So we need to talk about that at some point.
Speaking of lifespan, the next generation iPhone 5 due this fall. Tell us about what we can expect, George.
Well, it's all rumor, as always the case, but it's going to be a complete redesign. I mean, at least that was the original rumor on this, and they may change the design of the case on the back to be a little more rounded than the current phone. But specifically, it might have a slightly larger screen and obviously LTE 4G capability. So,
is that the only difference?
Well, don't know for sure. I mean, there's a camera in there. It's a pretty good camera now. I don't know that they could do a whole lot to make it better. I mean, it's got 8 megapixels, but who knows? I mean, things are always getting faster, smaller, cheaper.
It's evolutionary, right?
Yeah, right.
Speaking of new product releases, ubiquitous product releases. Windows 8 consumer preview release. Tom, what are we hearing so far about Windows 8?
This is really exciting stuff.
Are you being facetious?
I am.
Or are you serious?
I am sort of. I'm going to say sort of, and I'll tell you why. You know, we know that Windows 8's been in production for a long time. It's supposed to be released this fall, maybe, you know, toward Christmas, something like that. It has a different kind of look and feel to it, and so Microsoft has released a consumer preview. Now, what you can do is you can download this, and you can load it on a, you know, just like VirtualBox or something. I don't recommend just replacing your computer with the consumer preview of Windows 8. If you have a spare computer, that'd be fine, or you can do a little virtual computer, and that'll work okay.
What do you think of it so far as a Windows guy?
Here's where I'm going. It is optimized for touchscreens. So if you have a slate or a tablet type of PC with a touchscreen that you can use your fingers, then it's really cool because you can swipe and you know, use all the finger gestures to tell it what to do. And you can organize the screens kind of like on an iPad or iPhone. You know, it sort of has different screens that you can put different things on. Now, when you translate that to using it with a mouse, it's clunky.
Wow. And that's was going to be my follow-up question. Are they trying to go to touchscreens and interactivity with Windows 8, or are they sticking to the formula? It's clunky with the old formula.
Microsoft has always been really good at driving hardware. You know, they've always pushed the limit. And I'll just kind of go back. If you go back to pre-2000s, people were complaining about Microsoft because they made them get bigger hard drives. You know, or you have to get a faster computer to run Windows or whatever. Well, now here's the deal. You're going to want to get a touchscreen when you go to Windows 8 because it's going to be so much easier to use that way. So they're kind of pushing it in that – and they're trying to split the difference. They're trying to make it really good for the people that like to use their fingers to, you know, tell it where to go, and they're also trying to let you go backwards to using a mouse.
And it's a common theme in the industry to try to meld the features of tablets and smartphones with the look and feel on your computer. They're all trying to – kind of go in the same direction.
And speaking of which, new double resolution icons on OS 10 version 8
beta. Right.
What's happening with these Retina screens for future Mac?
Well, it's pretty obvious that Apple just introduced a Retina screen on the iPad, and of course the resolution is much better, but there's a downside. It takes more power to run those extra couple of million pixels that are there. But what they've done in the past is they take a look inside the under the hood of these beta software releases, and simply by examining the icons, they can tell if it's a got twice the resolution. There's really no need for that unless you're going to put it on a higher res display. So it looks like at some point, not too terribly far in the future, their other products, their computers and laptops, are going to have a Retina quality display.
And Thomas and George, the consulting company Wix.com launching an HTML5-enabled, do-it-yourself, Flash-enabled website service. What do we know about HTML5 and what it'll bring in terms of web surfing or...
Well, I think it's a good thing. It's being used now. It's just not pervasive at the moment. You know, as web developers get more familiar with the different components of HTML5, they begin to use them in their websites. One great example of it is video, for example. You know, instead of using Flash, which is a proprietary video technology from Adobe, you would use H.264 video that's embedded in HTML5. In their standard, and so it's a much more seamless way to build a web page, and you're not relying on third parties to deliver some technology. And I think everybody's familiar with how often you need to upgrade your Adobe technology, so if you don't have to do that, that's probably a good thing.
What's the learning curve like for HTML5?
Not big. If you're an existing web developer, it's not that big of a deal. It's just a matter of getting the opportunity to use it, I would say.
Speaking of proprietary releases by Adobe, there's a new free public beta of Photoshop, CS6 5.5.
Well, 5.5 is the current version. This is an advanced look at the Creative Suite 6 is what this is. And apparently, if you believe the hype that they're putting out, it's got a new engine inside, which they claim is going to drastically speed up the way the program works, which is a good thing, because if you know anybody that uses Photoshop, a lot of times you get complaints, about how long it takes to do certain things. But I think this is a good move on their part. It'll give existing customers an opportunity to understand and see some of the changes, and it'll drive sales.
Tom, what's your picture on this new Photoshop?
Oh, I have no big picture on it, really. Anything that's faster is going to be better.
This weekend, Microsoft took over some internet traffic for a window of time to take down the Zeus botnet. Remind us what botnets are, and how dangerous is it for a company to work with the federal government to take over internet traffic for a specific period of time just to track down a botnet?
Well, Zeus was pretty bad. In fact, there was a feature that was done on Zeus just a couple of days ago on Rock Center, the program on NBC, and they did a segment showing how it worked, and it was pretty amazing.
And China now leads the world in both iOS and Android device activations for mobile handsets. What does this mean, if anything?
It means there are a lot of people in China.
That's right.
And they're all going for phones.
How does this change the competitive landscape for mobile handsets and computing?
Hard to say at this moment. The early adopters are still the more established industrial economies.
Right.
China has to build out its network. It's got the same problems that we do in terms of the 4G and the ability to handle data and that sort of thing. And you'll find that in a lot of other places in the world, the cities have the greatest penetration, and you go out into the rural areas and there's nothing. Kind of the same as it is here in the U.S.
And speaking of China, what do we make of the Mike Daisy story on Apple products?
Mike Daisy?
Mike Daisy of the This American Life.
I missed that.
Oh, yeah. You have to refresh my memory because it was more than 2 weeks ago.
He told sort of a fictitious story about the process of how Apple products are made in China.
The guy that did the story that was...
That was kind of bogus.
Right. Actually, that whole controversy... was sort of typical in the way the media played it, because they looked at it as if it was attributable to Apple, number one, what was going on in those factories, And specifically, specifically Foxconn, which is the big producer. Foxconn bills for everybody. I mean, they make stuff
Apple,
for they make stuff for IBM and HP and Dell, and you know, I mean, Apple's just another customer. But the media was tagging what was happening at Foxconn, which has no connection to Apple. They're just a vendor, you know, as if it was Apple's fault, and it isn't.
I bet you that if they didn't have Apple to be a customer, they'd be very unhappy.
Well, that's true, but they're a huge company. I mean, they're building a giant facility in Brazil.
Should we be concerned about how Apple products or any hardware products are actually made?
Yes.
Yeah, up to a point. I mean, you know, they're in another country. It's a different culture. And in effect, you know, we can't be the world's policeman for everything. We
can be the world's conscience, though.
Yeah, that's true.
We can sure shame them
that's
into
true.
Doing the right thing, which
right.
is what we've done with textiles and clothing manufacturers. And I think we need to do it with the kind of devices that we carry around and use every day.
Is it possible to play both sides of the fence, though? Because you want cheaply manufactured
We're all hypocrites in that regard, right?
Right?
Yeah, we all
right.
want our smartphones, and we all want them to be done the right way, but we'll compromise.
And speaking of which, iPad 2 may be better and cheaper choice for consumers to avoid additional heat and power consumption, George?
Well, you know, there was
iPad 3.
Well, the thing about this, it all comes down to the Retina screen. There was nothing wrong you couldn't really say anything bad about the screen that was on the iPad 1 or the iPad 2. Perfectly good screen. But when you double the resolution, you got to push more light through those smaller pixels. So you're going to increase power consumption for both backlighting. You're going to increase power consumption in the graphics area. They've got a quad-core graphics processor now.
The battery in the iPad 3 is
bigger.
A 42-watt-hour battery compared to a 25-watt-hour battery.
It's much bigger, but the whole thing runs a little hotter and so on. So, I mean, for the average user, you know, the person that's not that particular, Apple is still selling the iPad 2. You can buy it for $399. And so it's cheaper, might be a better choice.
Is it safe to say, gentlemen, that battery power is still the biggest conundrum in computing?
Boy, someday we won't have to worry about batteries. Wouldn't that be cool?
It would be. Our computer guys are George Costello, an independent Apple consultant, and Thomas O'Brien, CEO of Ideology and Bold Internet Solutions. Thank you once again for coming to Central Standard, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay.
And tune in tomorrow as we discuss monetary theory and policy, which might sound dull to you, but it's the stuff that attracts stadiums full of Italians in Europe. To see members of our UMKC econ department and let them tell you about it tomorrow. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to date is next with Hardball host Chris Matthews. That's Hardball host Chris Matthews. Adjust your headsets and your volume. It could get loud there. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and this is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.